The storm has long passed, but Sandy's invisible health hazards linger. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The healthcare data that we provided to build these algorithms is equivalent to, I think, 5 Wikipedias.
You know, we're not really activists. You know, I'm a surgeon, and here it is. You know, there's a mistake happening. You pointed out.
It was not fun. Because they're injecting all this poison in you.
They actually took my PowerPoint projector and smashed it on the floor.
And it will go to an asteroid,
the
a large asteroid, actually,
rampant.
And pick a boulder.
There's good evidence that people with depression have more information, both in their...
It was never, in my mind, a life or death thing, even when they told me they weren't sure how serious it was.
On today's show, a man who is losing his sight but never his vision, a tough exam that has tested physicians for a century, and a big decision that could mean bigger health insurance bills for millions of Americans. But first up, Hurricane Sandy devastated the New Jersey shore nearly 3 years ago, but long-term health effects are still being uncovered. Public health officials say lead particles from destroyed homes that were churned up in the storm may pose a health risk. If inhaled or ingested, lead can cause developmental delays, miscarriages in pregnant women, and neurological problems in adults. 8 counties in New Jersey are testing residents for elevated blood lead through the end of this month. Carolyn Beeler reports.
Karen Caffrey is sitting at a table at a health fair in Galloway, New Jersey, offering up okay. One of her fingers for a prick.
Ah, oh, they didn't do it yet.
Nurse Sue Anello counts down.
1, 2, 3. That's it.
And hands her a piece of gauze.
Hold that with your thumb. All right.
Caffrey's getting tested because after Sandy, she had to clean and gut the entire first floor of her house on a lagoon in Brick, New Jersey.
I helped to just get rid of all the sludge, like there was all dirt and water and everything all over the floor, so I had to clean all that up, and we had to throw out the couches. We had to throw everything out.
Caffrey says when the storm surge rushed onto her property, it brought a lot of junk that made her wonder what else was in that water.
In our backyard, we had people's boats, people's like CD players, garbages with diapers in it and stuff. So that's what I was thinking.
It's possible that that water could have also deposited lead particles. That's according to Kathy Lardiere with the Ocean County Health Department.
All that water was pulling the debris from the bottom of the ocean, from the bays, and churning it all up. That lead might have been sitting down there for a long period of time, but it now was moved by the water to new locations.
Funded with federal disaster relief funds, Ocean County and 7 others affected by Sandy are testing residents to see if that churned up lead has made its way into people's bodies. Lardiere says there are many possible pathways. Residents demolishing homes built prior to 1978 could have exposed long covered over lead paint. Or lead from huge debris piles established after the storm could have worked its way into homes or yards.
It only takes a little speck of lead to cause lead poisoning when it's ingested. And if those debris piles were near playgrounds, homes, a little bit of wind, that could have blown that lead-impacted dust and soil to where people would be exposed that might not have otherwise even known it existed.
Symptoms of short-term lead exposure can include abdominal pain, irritability, and memory loss, but they may occur slowly and they could have other causes, so testing is necessary to catch lead poisoning. For people with elevated lead levels, it's important to find and remove the lead from the home environment and get follow-up testing to make sure blood level concentrations drop as the metal works its way out of the body. In extreme cases, lead poisoning can require hospitalization.
Oh, you're done. It's good.
Back at the health fair, Nurse Sue Anello tells Karen Caffrey she's unleaded and hands her the test results.
And you can show that to your doctor the next time you go.
Okay. Thank you.
Residents who step up to the health department's booth can also request lead testing in their homes. Ocean County Assistant Public Health Coordinator Matthew Cheek says even after people strip and scrub their homes, lead can linger.
Because it can be left in little nooks and crannies that you really can't get to. You know, it can be that people were handling debris and that paint then chipped off. That may have been after you've already gutted the first, say, 4 feet of your walls.
In addition to home visits, Cheek's team is collecting soil samples from at least 30 high-risk zones around the county, focusing on those old debris pile sites.
We want to look at that property where that pile was to see what could have leached into the soil, what could have blown into the soil, those types of things.
A study conducted after Hurricane Katrina demolition and rebuilding found nearly two-thirds of homes and yards tested in New Orleans had elevated levels. Cheek, whose testing runs from this April to the end of September, doesn't think the results will be as bad on the New Jersey shore, where houses are newer.
New Jersey just simply is a little less likely to have the residential lead-based paint as the source, but that's why the grant is looking at things like debris management areas, water towers, things like that.
In the first 10 months of testing, about 6% of children 17 or under in seven Sandy-affected counties had recorded lead levels in their blood about 5 micrograms per liter. That's the federally recommended level for public health interventions. Preliminary data suggests that may be slightly higher than pre-Sandy levels, though public health officials caution that differences in testing programs before and after the storm make direct comparisons difficult. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
It's The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our next story is about a new drug that has landed smack in the middle of a women's rights debate, or perhaps it's more accurate to say that it was nudged into the middle of this debate. The pill has been dubbed Female Viagra, or the little pink pill, and it's once again being reviewed by the FDA for approval right now. The drug's real name is flibanserin, and it's backed by a big lobbying campaign titled Even the Score. Flibanserin is supposed to treat women who have been diagnosed with hypoactive sexual desire disorder, meaning they have no desire to have sex. Joining us now to discuss the drug and the stir it has caused is Cheryl Kingsburg. She is chief of behavioral medicine at University Hospital's Case Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio, and she's also a paid consultant for Sprout Pharmaceuticals, which makes flibanserin. Cheryl, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, the drug flibanserin has been rejected by the FDA 2 times already. Do you think the 3rd time will be the charm, so to speak?
I am very hopeful that the 3rd time will finally be the charm, and I think millions of women are also hopeful.
Now, tell me, what does the drug do for women and sexual desire?
Well, flibanserin works in the brain. And in theory, it works to correct some dysregulation of neurotransmitters. When we're thinking about desire, and the condition that flibanserin treats is called hypoactive sexual desire disorder, it reflects the loss of interest, the wanting to have sexual activity. And theoretically, the reasons behind this are both biologic and psychologic, and the drug flibanserin addresses the biologic causes of hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And what we think is that, just like with depression, there are changes in brain chemistry for these women that affects their interest in, their wanting to have sexual activity.
What happens to women when they lose sexual desire?
Well, we have data, actually, that women that suffer from HSDD have a profound negative impact on their quality of life, on their perception of their body image, on their relationships. I can tell you clinically, and a colleague of mine, Barry McCarthy, has said this so eloquently, when sex is good in a relationship, it's good. It adds some value, maybe 15 to 20% added value. But when sex is bad or non-existent, it is profoundly detrimental to a relationship, draining it more like 50 to 70%. So let me repeat here, bad sex does way more to subvert an otherwise good relationship than good sex can sort of save an average one.
And how many women are affected by hypoactive sexual desire disorder?
We estimate anywhere between 7 to 10% of all U.S. women. It is a very large problem affecting millions of women.
The drug we're talking about is very different from Viagra, right? Even though it's been called female Viagra, but it works in a completely different way.
Yes, it works very differently. You know, in simple terms, I almost like the way that that it's been deemed as the pink Viagra, because it reflects similar concepts in terms of being the first drug to treat female sexual dysfunction compared to Viagra, which was the first drug to address erectile dysfunction. But their treatments are very different. For Viagra, the issue is about erectile dysfunction and really focuses on blood flow, whereas flibanserin works to address hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which is the most common sexual problem for women and really is about the central nervous system.
So even though the term female Viagra is perhaps comparing apples to oranges, you think it's still a good term?
Yes, I'm perfectly happy with it because it reflects, again, the idea that it is a treatment for women and women's sexual concerns.
The lobbying campaign to get this drug approved has the title Even the Score. What's the score we're talking about?
The score is that there are drugs that are approved by the FDA to treat some form of male sexual dysfunction, whether it be erectile dysfunction or loss of drive or erectile problems that are related to testosterone deficiency. And there are zero approved drugs for any form of female sexual dysfunction except the vaginal atrophy that is the result of menopause.
Has turning this debate into a kind of political issue, a feminist issue, has that put a lot of pressure on the FDA that may not be helpful in some ways? I mean, it may be helpful to your cause, but what about the patients?
I don't know how the FDA feels about this. I guess you'd have to ask them. But I think that this is all about the patient, and it's always been about the patient. You know, I've been treating these women, hundreds of them, for the last 25 years, and there has been no available pharmacologic option for them, and I've watched them suffer. I think many of them can benefit from psychotherapy. That's what I do in my practice, and I hope I do it pretty well. But there is a whole group of women for whom they have a biologic cause of their loss of desire, and I have no options for them.
And you don't think the whole man versus woman aspect of this drug has been kind of played up a bit to put pressure on the FDA?
No, I think that the gender disparity in what is approved is real. And it does put some pressure to say, look, you know, when we look at risk benefit, that's where I think the double standard has come in. That for men, if you look at the drugs and the side effects and the risks that some of these drugs have, you kind of wonder when you look at, you know, heart attack or hearing loss or, you know, even penile rupture as potential risks for drugs that have been approved for men. And when we look at the most common adverse events for flibanserin, it's sleepiness, dizzy, nausea, headaches. So, you know, when you look at this comparison of risk-benefit, it does look like there's a little bit of a double standard saying women's sexual health is not sort of worthy of any amount of risk compared to men's sexual health.
Cheryl, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Cheryl Kingsburg is Chief of Behavioral Medicine at University Hospital's Case Medical Center. She's also a consultant for Sprout Pharmaceuticals, which makes flibanserin. Coming up, a tough test that has put physicians on edge for a century.
A student was given a tray with two pieces of fresh dog intestine.
Proving suturing skills on dog guts is not happening anymore, but the medical licensing exam remains a Herculean task. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca, offering resources to help patients afford and access their medicines. The AZ and Me patient assistance programs provided more than 382,000 patients in the U.S. with more than $670 million in savings in 2014. AstraZeneca Direct offers a range of patient support services, including delivery of brand-name prescription medications directly to a person's home. More at AstraZeneca-US.com.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. After medical school, all those sleepless nights and tough exams, physicians have another major challenge to get through, the United States Medical Licensing Exam. 1,100 questions spread over 5 days. Fail and you cannot practice medicine in this country. The group that comes up with those questions, the National Board of Medical Examiners, celebrates its 100th anniversary this year. Todd Bookman takes a look at how the test has evolved during the past century.
Before the NBME, there wasn't a single test. Each state came up with its own licensing exam, which turned out to be something of a frustration for Dr. William Rodman.
In the late 1800s, he was offered a position in Philadelphia. He was in Kentucky as a professor of surgery at the University of Kentucky, and he accepted that position and was appalled by two things. First of all, he had to take another exam. This prominent author of textbooks, educator, came to Pennsylvania and they said, you have to take our exam to get a license. Secondly, he took the exam and thought it was an awful exam.
This is Don Melnick, president of the National Board of Medical Examiners. He says Rodman's Pennsylvania experience stuck with him. He would spend much of the next two decades trying to gain support for one test, a national exam so good that the states would want to use it to license doctors rather than administering their own. A good idea on the surface, but not one the individual states were necessarily ready to accept. Cue the Constitution.
Well, just like today, the 10th Amendment focus on rights of states to manage their own affairs is a pretty powerful political dynamic. Back in 1915, it was the same way. And so the notion of a national, not a federal, but a national entity being involved in assessing qualifications for licensure was seen as anathema by many and an intrusion on states' rights and state autonomy.
So Rodman proposed a voluntary national board exam, just an option for states and med students to consider. The idea got backing from the United States military, which was closely watching a war break out in Europe. A rigorous test, the armed services figured, could help ensure the best doctors were identified to serve at the front. And so the first national board exam was administered the following year in Washington, D.C.
It lasted for 6 days, and it was a complex examination that included essays, oral, bedside examination of skills, and real clinical skills exams. My favorite item from the first exam was that a student was given a tray with two pieces of fresh dog intestine. They had to suture the ends of the intestine together, and then one end was clamped off and they put water in it to a certain water pressure, and if the anastomosis line did not leak, they passed that item. A real clinical skills exam of a very practical test for someone who was doing surgery in those days.
Suturing, anatomy, physiology, and dogs. 10 men took the test, just 5 passed. Over time, the concept of a national exam gained steam. By 1943, all but 3 states recognized the NBME's boards as an alternative to their own licensing system. But by the 1950s, a new type of test question was coming into vogue, a simpler, more black-and-white way to measure knowledge, the multiple choice. After much consideration, NBME phased in this new approach. It did not go over well.
Not only did we hear pushback, but a large number of the states that recognized our certification for licensure declined to recognize this newfangled superficial exam that had just multiple choice questions.
A dozen states up and quit, said we can do better than having med students fill in bubbles on a sheet of loose leaf. But the NBME stuck to its guns, and for the next 40 years, the test remained multiple choice. Three different tests, actually, given at intervals over the course of med school and residency training. Then, in the early 2000s, another big change. One of the original components from the 1916 exam got a second wind, the patient interaction.
It's just amazing how long it's taken for the concept of communication skills by physicians in their encounters with patients to be taken seriously.
Ruth Hoppe works with the NBME on assessing physician communication abilities. For those of us on the receiving end of a stethoscope, these skills are crucial, and not just because they make us feel more human. Research shows patients do better, are more likely to fill prescriptions and seek follow-up care when the doctor-patient relationship is stronger. A century ago, that idea would have been laughed off, says Kim Edward LeBlanc. He runs the clinical skills portion of the test.
You went to the doctor, didn't know what you had, you left, you didn't know what you had, but you had a bottle of medicine. So now those days are fortunately for the most part are gone, so that at least the doctor can communicate with you, act like a professional, not laugh at you for whatever you're complaining of, and you, when you leave, you should have a very reasonable expectation to, one, know what your diagnosis is, and what's the treatment plan here.
On the modern exam, each doctor now spends a day in a test-taking center, seeing standardized patients, what the rest of us would call actors, who fake symptoms following carefully scripted scenarios. The interaction along with the diagnosis get graded. Judging by the results, most doctors are pretty good at this. In 2014, 96% of U.S. medical school graduates passed this portion on the first attempt. In fact, pass rates for all parts of the NBME tests, which are now called the United States Medical Licensing Exam, are in the mid-90s. That, in part, is a reflection of just how much med students cram for these things.
Pretty much 80 hours in the library, plus, you know, breaks and sleeping now and again, hopefully eating, and ideally taking care of yourself, but you tend to sacrifice one or the other.
Like many med students, Priya Joshi calls the Step 1 portion the single biggest test soon-to-be doctors take. That's because hospitals heavily weight it when determining who to offer residencies to. And how prestigious your residency placement is can have deep ripples in your career. Not everyone loves having so much hang on a single thread.
The general idea is, like, so if your score is higher, you're a smarter doctor, but I guess the question would be, what makes a good doctor? And I don't know if that necessarily correlates with a higher Step 1 score.
Joshi just graduated from Sidney Kimmel Medical College last month and will start her residency at Penn in a few weeks. She says, on the flip side, all that studying did tie together the endless lectures and PowerPoints endured during the first 2 years of school.
I mean, there's something nice about, like, your family members calling you and you're like, oh, I know what kind of rash you have on your back, you know, because you finally get it. And it's like, okay, it's clicking. And that feels really good.
Of course, it's easy to say that after the test is over. Today, the NBME is recognized by all 50 states, though it took until 1994 before Texas came on board. That would have pleased Dr. William Rodman, who never got to see the test he fought for in action. Rodman died suddenly in 1916, just months before the first exams were given. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
When it comes to medicine, we assume that there is a system in place to protect us, right? Just like those licensing exams to make sure everything is up to par, standardized, and safe. But with labs, the places where you send your blood work and other tests, that safety system is perhaps less solid than most of us would like to believe. We usually just accept our test results and assume that everything was done right. An investigative report by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found that labs are far from perfect and that mistakes are hidden from the public by a secretive inspection system. I talked to Ellen Gabler, the reporter who spent months uncovering the facts of this story, and I asked her to give me some examples of the mistakes she discovered.
The implication of wrong lab test is really serious. In my story, I, you know, wrote about a man who was told he was HIV positive when he wasn't, and it essentially broke up his marriage for some time. There was another woman who had a test done in the beginning of her pregnancy that was supposed to detect some antibodies in her blood, and the test wasn't done properly, and her baby ended up dying after he was born. She had a condition that can be treated if it's caught early, but it wasn't, and so the child died. There's another case where a man was told he wasn't the father of a little girl, a baby he had helped raise for the first 3 months of her life. So obviously he was extremely upset about that, and she really was his daughter. So lab tests affect 70% of medical decisions, and they also affect other things like paternity. I just thought it was fascinating how these lab tests could be wrong.
Yeah, I have to admit, until I read your story, I have never questioned a single lab result I've gotten, just because I just thought, well, they tested it and here we are.
Yeah. Even something as small as a cholesterol test can have an effect on your life, right? So if you have high cholesterol, you might be put on cholesterol-lowering medicine. And, you know, it's not the hugest deal, but I think that's pretty significant to all of a sudden have to start taking a medication.
Generally speaking, how are labs regulated?
The federal government is the ultimate regulator of labs, but there's a variety of private accrediting organizations that actually do the inspections of most of the labs that do your medical tests.
And how often are the labs inspected?
The labs that do the, you know, more complicated tests, they're inspected once every 2 years. The problem, though, is for the most part, these inspection reports are secret.
So who's allowed to see them?
Well, the private accrediting groups are. And in some cases, the federal government can release them if they lead to a very serious sanction. But that hardly ever happens.
So if I'm about to have blood work done, I have no way of knowing if the lab I'm using or my medical provider is using has made some terrible mistakes.
That's correct. I will say, you know, in some cases, labs that have had serious problems do receive violations. But my investigation showed that there can be very, very serious life-threatening violations in a lab and nobody would know about it.
What happens when a lab is found to have done something wrong?
The federal government basically proposes a sanction, but very rarely is the sanction imposed. And the reason that's important is because only the sanctions that are imposed become public. And so in 2013, only 90 sanctions were imposed, and that's out of 35,000 labs in the whole country.
And what is a sanction like? Do they get a big fine, or is there a follow-up to make sure it doesn't happen again?
There are different levels of sanctions. It can be a fine of, you know, a couple thousand dollars. Their testing can be limited, so they might not be allowed to test for a certain analyte, or they could be shut down.
Could you see your report leading to any kind of change? I mean, that's always the hope, right, when reporters go and cover these things.
I'm not sure what will happen. You know, I personally think that transparency is really important in a lot of things in government. It's also very important in healthcare. The labs, you know, they don't want this information public, and the accrediting organizations also obviously don't want this information public. And so that's a problem. It is complicated what the laboratories are doing, but it doesn't make sense to keep problems like this hidden.
Ellen Gabler is a reporter at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's written about lab failures. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Megan Scott. Do Americans have Charlie Brown ears when it comes to important healthcare news?
The Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court has agreed to take up a new challenge.
Justices announcing they will review another controversial part of Obamacare. It involves tax credit subsidies for policies
blocked. A recent poll found that half of Americans were unaware the Supreme Court is once again debating the Affordable Care Act. This time, it's about the subsidies people can receive to pay for their insurance. The outcome could affect health coverage for millions of people. And if you think that most states are prepared with backup plans, think again. Alana Gordon reports.
Online marketplaces are a central part of the Affordable Care Act. They launched a year and a half ago. It's where 27-year-old Catherine Ryan, a restaurant server in Philadelphia, immediately turned to for coverage.
I was excited because if it weren't for Obamacare, I wouldn't be insured at all. I wouldn't have the ability to go to the doctor. which is pretty crazy.
She's had to for some stomach issues, and she can afford it thanks to a $200 a month discount that brings her premium down to $60. Ryan, who's studying social work, is one of nearly 400,000 Pennsylvanians who've qualified for income-based subsidies. But like a lot of people, she had no idea that a case before the Supreme Court puts them at risk.
I mean, you telling me this is like my heart has sank a bit to the bottom of my stomach because I was planning on keeping this insurance until I am gainfully employed with an agency that offers benefits.
The reason Ryan and millions of other people's subsidies nationwide are in jeopardy, as Drexel professor Robert Field explains, has to do with four key words in the law.
So the magic words are established by the state.
A lawsuit before the Supreme Court argues that, as that phrase spells out, only those with coverage in state-based marketplaces are eligible for subsidies. The feds argue that's not the intent. No one knows what will happen. But if the court strikes down the subsidies in federal marketplaces, Trish Riley with the National Association of State Health Policy says it could result in what a lot of policy wonks refer to as a death spiral.
The whole individual market in states could collapse.
Without those subsidies, millions would likely drop their coverage, except really sick people who need expensive care. They'd keep their plans. So then
premiums go through the roof.
And then no one can afford it. So how are states bracing for this? Pennsylvania actually has a backup plan.
I'm just doing this because I want to be prepared.
Governor Tom Wolf sent in a blueprint to the feds this past week to create a state-supported marketplace that would still use the healthcare.gov website. Wolf stresses this is just a contingency.
My biggest concern is, do we have a fallback if we need it?
The state's new insurance commissioner, Teresa Miller, says it's all been really rushed.
It's forcing us to put together a plan that, frankly, most states spent years developing, and we're having to do that essentially in months.
It's unclear how soon the state could even transition to a model where it would oversee the funding and regulations. But the move is actually pretty unusual.
Pennsylvania stands out.
Joel Ario is a healthcare consultant and former federal official. He says the marketplaces, like the Affordable Care Act as a whole, can be really politically divisive. Wolf, a Democrat, recently took over for a Republican governor. But elsewhere, a lot of state leaders don't want anything to do with the law, and by default, they have federal marketplaces. Ario says to have a state-based marketplace, first and foremost, a state has to actually be on board with it.
In about a third of the states, that is a political non-starter today, because it does mean standing up and saying, I want to work with this law in a public way as a state-based exchange.
Arizona and Arkansas have enacted legislation barring any sort of state-based marketplace. A New Jersey spokesperson says it's premature to address any of this. Then there are a few states that fall into a gray zone. That includes Delaware. It has a federal marketplace, but it's really active in overseeing it. So now?
We haven't shut any door, and we haven't made a definitive answer just yet.
Rita Landgraf is Delaware's Health and Social Services Director. She says the state had looked into setting up a regional marketplace with other states. Too complicated. They explored the state-run option early on. Too costly for such a small state. Now, as a contingency, like Pennsylvania, they've submitted a plan for a state-supported one. As for Catherine Ryan, that waitress in Philadelphia, the thought of all these possible disruptions with her coverage...
That's a little nerve-wracking.
She's finally starting to figure out how her insurance plan even works.
I hope it just stays the way it is, but at least there's a backup option. That's good news.
Federal officials aren't saying how many other states have contingency plans, but that's in part because right now, all eyes are focused on the biggest unknown of all, the Supreme Court. A decision is expected by the end of the month. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up, doctors, daddies, doulas, so many people are in the room when women give birth. Scientists are tracing the evolutionary reason for this. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
actively supporting nonprofit organizations that increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region. AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Moms giving birth are surrounded by a big crew these days. They'll usually have their partners by their side, perhaps a parent or a friend, maybe a doula to coach them through the breathing and pushing. And while the cast of characters in the birthing room has changed over the decades, birth has long been a social affair. Tanya English joins us now, and she's learned there may be an evolutionary reason for all of this. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Maiken.
You've been researching this topic. What did you find out?
You know, I spoke with Karen Rosenberg from the University of Delaware. She studies fossils from all over the world, and she wants to understand how humans have evolved. And there's a name for that. She's a paleoanthropologist. I asked her of all the things that we could learn from fossils, why does she want to know more about childbirth? Let's listen to what she said.
Childbirth is something that everyone experiences one way or another, and that's quite different in humans than it is in other animals. Humans have a more complicated, more difficult, and perhaps riskier time giving birth. And that's related to two features of our anatomy, namely the fact that we're bipedal, walk on two legs, and the fact that we have large brains. The baby's head really just barely fits. If we had smaller brains, we wouldn't have high risks during childbirth as we do.
Let's break that down. So we walk on two legs. Something happened with our pelvis to help us with that?
Right. Our pelvis is completely modified from the kind of pelvis that our ape ancestor would have had. The actual birth canal in an ape is a sort of straight tube, whereas in humans, it's a kind of curved tube. So at the top, it's wide from side to side, and then it becomes long from front to back, and then approximately circular. And so it's a very, very tight squeeze. It would be like if you were trying to put an egg through a toilet paper tube, right? And the toilet paper tube were smashed to the side at one point, and you would have to twist the egg to make it pass through.
The baby makes these rotations all along this journey along the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. The shape of our pelvis changed 5 to 7 million years ago in our ancestors, people like Lucy. Everybody's heard of Lucy, the famous Ethiopian fossil from 3 to 3.5 million years ago. And so that completely modified the pelvis. And that was for reasons that had to do with walking. Then later in our evolutionary history, starting between 2 and 3 million years ago, we start to get large brains. And when the brains got big, further modifications in the pelvis had to be made and further modifications in the mechanism of birth. Historically, death in childbirth was the leading cause of death for women of childbearing age.
When we talk about other mammals, they usually go off by themselves to give birth. Why is
that? Absolutely. So she's hiding from predators. She might be attracting attention to predators. She's hiding from interfering members of her own species. And humans do just the opposite of that. When humans give birth, we look for people to be around us. We find our sisters, our husbands, our mothers, and our midwives or obstetricians. We're looking to have people there to help us.
So part of your theory is that it's anatomy that has moved us to call in help when we're giving birth.
Yes. So we think that women benefit from having an assistant for a bunch of reasons, clearing the baby's breathing passage by lifting the baby out of the birth canal without injuring its neck or its spinal cord. Human babies are born in a kind of an unusual condition compared to our close relatives. Our babies are helpless but big. So when you think about the attention that human babies suck up from their families, the fact that they need care for a long time and the fact that they're big things to carry around, as most people remember, is really important as well.
What do you think these lessons from 2 million years ago or theories about how we've evolved can tell us for the 21st century?
Looking at childbirth in an evolutionary context gives us some insight into how to practice modern obstetrics or modern midwifery, because it encourages us to understand that the way that women behave during childbirth makes evolutionary sense. right? And that thinking about seeking assistance is an important consequence of the constraints that are imposed on us by our biology.
Karen Rosenberg is a paleoanthropologist at the University of Delaware. She studies the evolution of birth. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Mikan, so these days, many couples are paying a professional to be with them and support them during labor and delivery. This paid companion is called a doula. That's spelled D-O-U-L-A. They work in hospitals, birth centers, and now there's some evidence that hiring a doula, having her at your bedside, can really reduce the cesarean section rate. And women who have this kind of continuous support really report higher satisfaction with their birth experience. I spoke with doula Dawn Star Sarah's Borsch Shelt and brand new mom Colleen Friends.
So it was something that was on my radar, but it wasn't something I thought I needed or wanted until I realized that I wanted to have a natural childbirth in a hospital. My name is Colleen Friends. My husband is Basil Friends. We have a new son, he's 9.5 weeks old, Eamon Friends. We hired Dawn Star as our doula, and we're very happy that we did so. Mostly, my biggest fear was that I would give in and want an epidural, and I wanted her to say, no, Colleen, remember what you really want. This is, you're in pain now, so you want to relieve it, but you really want to do this without an epidural. I knew, and I thought it was going to be the hardest thing I had ever done. Not only is that scary, but you really have no idea what it's going to be like before you go through it. No matter what you read or what anybody tells you, you can't know. And it really helped to have someone who knew what they were talking about, who's been through it many, many times, not only having her own children, but being present for a lot of births.
I'm Dawn Star Sarah's Borschel. I'm a birth doula with mainline doulas. I don't do any medical care, so I don't check her cervix, I don't take her blood pressure, I don't take her temperature, anything like that. I don't do any of that. What I do is provide hands-on and emotional support, something like, do you want to try getting on your hands and knees? And you can try it and say, no, this isn't working, and I'll still have 5 or 6 other ideas about how you might cope with the intensity that you're experiencing at that time.
It had been a really stressful day because I was exactly a week late at that point. I was in my 41st week. And then at 7:30 that night, I had my first contraction, and I was right here on this couch, kneeling on the ground or kneeling on the couch. And just me and my husband, I said at some point, I had been thinking probably, I don't know, a bunch of contractions. This is so hard. I want that epidural. And I told him, he said, okay. So, but then when she got there, it was like this boost of support. Okay, I can do this. The thought went out of my head of getting an epidural.
I am so complimented by that. That makes me really happy. So when you're at that part of labor, there's not a whole lot anybody else can do for you. You just have to do it yourself. And unfortunately, even if medical care providers have the very best intentions, they have a job to do. Their job is providing medical care to keep the mom safe. A doula is there just for one mom for that birth. I think that that's what provides the feeling of well-being for the mom.
Who's that baby? Say bye, baby.
That was birth companion or doula Dawn Star Sarah's Borschelt and brand new mom Colleen Friends.
And Tanya, how much does this service cost?
You know, it can be $800 to $1,200, and you pay that in advance before the birth.
So no matter what happens, you pay.
Yes. So they're not guaranteeing that you're not going to have a cesarean section. It's for the service of being at your bedside. And even though this is pricey, business seems like it's good. I spoke with the owner of Mainline Doulas in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. Back in 2011, there was just one person. Now they have 25 doulas.
Wow. And I guess having a coach, a birthing coach by your side is perhaps a little bit like a personal trainer. They hold you accountable to stick to the plan.
Yeah, that's what Colleen told me. She said when things got rough during labor, she remembers thinking that she didn't want to let Dawn down.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
Thank you.
Hey, You're listening to The Pulse. Morgan Fitzpatrick Andrews has long known that he would eventually lose his sight, but he's never lost his creative vision. He's a theater maker, a puppeteer, punk musician, and a yoga instructor. He also has a rare congenital eye disease called Cone-rod dystrophy 5. In a new solo performance piece entitled Cones, Andrews challenges ideas of vision loss and what's associated with it. He told us about it for this week's edition of our series, Patient Files.
So I became aware when I was a little kid that I was seeing these dots everywhere. And I felt like I had some sort of superpower, like I could see atoms. Like if you look at an old TV set and it has that sort of static, all those dots that make up the image in the cathode ray tube monitor. That's what the world looks like to me. When I was younger, the first medium that I gravitated toward was music, because it was like, well, I'm losing my vision. Guess I'll be the blind guy on the porch playing the guitar. And then I took a different turn and decided that what I wanted to do was rehabilitate my vision. So I became a graphic artist, working a lot with woodblock prints. And I liked that a lot because with the woodcuts, it was more like I was pulling these images out of the darkness. And then I got really into shadow puppetry because I wanted to use this process of carving things out of blackness to tell stories.
My dad, who didn't live with me and my mom, he was legally blind. In fact, half the people on that side of my family were legally blind. So my eye doctor wanted to keep my vision, which was also really, really bad, in check. So he would sit me down about 20 feet away from this eye chart, and he would point to it, and he would say, what it is on this first line.
A lot of the work that I've done as an artist has been very much shaped by my Cone-rod dystrophy. The reality is that my vision is deteriorating in a certain way, and part of the process of making art is to see what can emerge in its place.
And the reason why you come back every year and your eyes are worse and worse and worse, and I have to give you stronger and stronger and stronger prescription, is because it is the cells, the hereditary condition that you have, the little cones in the back of your eye.
So I'm making this piece called Cones, and I wanted to make a piece that was about living somewhere in the space between blindness and sightedness. And for someone like me that has a retinal disease, that is so front and center. That space and that expectation of what seeing is supposed to be, and also the expectation of what blindness is supposed to be. We are all somewhere on the spectrum between sighted and blind, and that changes from any given moment. Like if you are out in the sun and then you suddenly come into a dark space and there's all these spots in front of your eyes, you can't see. For some of us, those moments of being temporarily disabled are longer or more frequent. But there's this in-between space that so many people fall into with low vision. So I have to make a choice to either be the person walking down the street with dark glasses and a white cane to show everyone that I'm blind.
See? See? Hear? Hearing is seeing. Seeing is hearing.
Or I'm the person riding my bike and waving hello back to people who I can't even really see. Sometimes people with disabilities will pass as more able-bodied to avoid stigma and judgment. And it's a conversation that's not really talked about. There's lots of media representations of people that are fully blind. You know, you can think of like Oedipus or King Lear when the guy gets his eyes gouged out.
Upon these eyes of thine I'll set my mark.
Or superheroes like Daredevil or Tommy by The Who. You know, it's like all or nothing. But there are very few media representations of people that are partially blind or losing their vision. So in making this piece called Cones about my Cone-rod dystrophy, I'm using the cone, the shape cone, as an inroad to talk about the cones that aren't as visible.
Invisible and visible. Visible and invisible.
So there are all these things that I can't see. But then there are all sorts of things that I notice that the normally sighted 20/20 person who doesn't have an eye disease, they don't see the things that I see.
Morgan Fitzpatrick Andrews is a theater maker with a rare congenital eye disease called Cone-rod dystrophy 5. His new solo performance piece, Cones, premieres Friday, June 19th at the Rotunda in Philadelphia as part of the Solo Festival. Jonathan Pfeffer produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Our new intern is Karen Chakurji. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor. Meg Pinto is our executive producer. And she's getting married this weekend, so we wish her lots of happiness. And Meg, enjoy that honeymoon. Chris Atulo is Vice President of News and Christine Dempsey, our Chief Content Officer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just sign up for our podcast. It's on iTunes or on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's also where you can get in touch with us, and I hope that you do, because we love to hear from you. Your feedback, your questions, send it our way. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.